Welcome to Blog Talk Radio. This is Westchester on the Level with your host, Hezzy Eris.
Good morning, everyone. Today we're talking to none other than Orrin M. Levin-Waldman. He's a socioeconomic research scholar, and he's going to be talking to us today about his most recent essay, which is entitled Mainstream Economics Too Often Ignore the Power Imbalance in Labor Markets. And so all very, very exciting discussion, and the reading is just huge. So why is this becoming more and more relevant? Is it because we are coming out of the COVID crisis and people are attempting to get back to work, and yet the amount of monies that are being offered to workers on all levels is not quite what it used to be, particularly with the people who don't have an educational background or a skill background to get an affordable housing, affordable salary component so that they can survive?
Well, I think the short of it is that most public policy, at least in terms of economic policy, is sort of developed, put together by mainstream economists. And mainstream economists do not really consider power. It never has been a consideration in the model, but they base all policy on this power dynamic. And then some come along and say, okay, so we can't do anything about the market, but we can sort of deal with the consequences of the market. So let's have massive spending on various programs, and that'll solve the problem. It doesn't really solve the problem, but that's what they think, and makes them feel good.
And so why did we get on that sort of road? Or is it just simply to pump the economy where there are people who don't have the capacity to earn a living, or they've been, or their hours have been shortened, or the companies that they work for are paying them less because there's so many workers looking for a job? And it's depressing wages, then is this just to pump up the economy because people will spend it the minute they get it because they don't have anything else?
Well, part of it is you want to pump up the economy, so give people money so they can buy things. So if they can buy things, you can have aggregate demand for goods and services, the economy starts to pick up, and, you know, that creates jobs, whatever. But it's short-sighted. And, you know, we reached the point where nobody's willing to consider the fact that there is a power dynamic which needs to be addressed. And, you know, mainstream economics or economic theory is really a rationalization for a status quo. And that's true of all ideologies and political philosophies and economic theory. So basically what you're doing is you're rationalizing the distribution of power such as it is. And then you're saying, but it's not really a problem because workers and firms are equal in their bargaining capacity. And if we treat them as equals, then there's really no role for government to play in terms of addressing things like market failure and the fact that some people are going to be left out and left behind.
Well, you've always spoken about that, you know, quite strongly, to point out that there is a disparity between the employer and the one seeking employment, and that they're not on equal footing. And at the end of the day, you know, people who have little means, either their own intellectual capacity or education or otherwise, or bigotry or some form of bias, they don't have a choice. They either take the job at whatever rate they get, as you point out, because they need to eat and to pay rent and all those other things. They don't have much of a choice, and the remuneration from these companies, as you point out in your essay, is not getting bigger. It's getting lower and smaller. So how can we still, why are we still at this game, and why don't we institute all those things that are going to make it better for everyone overall? And does big business suffer if the worker makes a little bit more money?
No, they still come out on top, but you know, the issue is that the argument they make is they want to be competitive, and to be competitive in a global economy, you know, you have to basically be able to control wage rates, and if you're competing with countries where wage rates are a fraction of what they are in the United States, then we have to find a way to end workers' wage rigidity, force them to take lower wages. Otherwise, we just take our capital and move it elsewhere.
Is that the only dynamic? It could either be either people accept lower wages, or the corporations are going to move abroad. And then do we have to accept whatever they do abroad and purchase that here? Or can we put tariffs to make it onerous for a company to say, well, I'm moving to China because I pay half of what I would pay here in the United States?
Well, that's exactly what's been happening for the last few decades. And yeah, we can impose tariffs all we want. But, you know, it doesn't really solve the problem either, because then companies from abroad are not likely to invest in the United States. So it becomes a problem, and you also hurt domestic interests with tariffs as much as you hurt foreign interests. So it doesn't really solve your problem. And, you know, arguably, I don't want to be a conspiracy theorist here, but, you know, if you do take the view that China is keeping something from the world in terms of the origins of the coronavirus, one has to wonder what Trump was thinking when he decided to engage in a trade war with China.
Mm-hmm. In what sense? What would have been the intent, or do we even know yet?
I don't think we know yet, but if there's a reason to believe that China was working on a virus in the lab, or enhancing a virus in the lab, for purposes of biological warfare, you know, as a way of, I think what we do know is there was intelligence information about this as early as November of 2019. The administration sat on, didn't want to do anything, didn't want to jeopardize a trade deal that Trump thought he was close to achieving. Now, is it possible that if the Chinese are as evil as some might make them out to be, that maybe this was a response to the trade war, to the tariffs in the first place?
Uh-huh. And yet, why is America investing in the studies that they had at Wuhan? Why are we investing in their search for whatever they were doing? Why are we investing there? Why aren't we investing here? Is it cheaper to invest there when they don't share the information? And we knew that they weren't going to be open. They never have been.
Maybe it's naivete on the part of the NIH. I mean, I think it's part of their normal grant process. So somebody applied, a institution in China or wherever else around the world applies for a grant to the NIH, and it basically meets the criteria for getting a grant, the grant is given. So, you know, to say that some people on the right are saying, well, we gave them this virus and we were in cahoots with them, I think that's sort of nonsense. But I think the NIH, along with a lot of other government agencies in the United States, do give grants to foreign researchers. Now, do we control what they do with the grant money once they have it? That's a little hard.
No.
We claim that they have to file reports. Fine, you can file whatever reports you want, but they can sort of be forced and fudged and whatever, and we have no way of knowing what they're doing. The other thing is grant money is fungible. So if you get grant money to research in one area, it frees up money to do things in other areas.
Mm-hmm. Well, so, I guess it does. I guess it would have cost us probably less to invest with the Chinese, but even the World Health Organization didn't respond and didn't take our position. They seemed to side with China, and yet we're funding them. I think under Trump, he stopped the funding, and now we put it back in. And what's the logic of that when we know that they aren't open with the information?
Well, it's only becoming evident now that they're not open with the information. I think the starting position of this administration, as was the starting position of the Trump administration and the starting position of the Obama administration, was whatever the previous administration did was terrible. So we have to reverse whatever the previous administration did. We can't recognize anything good that the previous administration did. So we have to basically undo what they did. And this is clearly the case in this administration with the first few, several, 20, 30, whatever, executive orders are reversing actions that were taken by the Trump administration. If Trump said that China was evil, then China must be good as far as Joe Biden is concerned. If Trump called it the Wuhan virus or Kung flu or whatever you want to call it, then obviously we have to find a way to say that's not true. If Trump started warp speed, then clearly we can't acknowledge that that may have put us ahead of the game in terms of getting out vaccines. It's warped and it's distorted our political view of the world. But when we cease to view actions of the United States government as precisely that, actions of the United States government, regardless of which administration is in power, then it's not clear where we're headed. It's all partisanship, and basically there's no sense of the public interest any longer.
Yeah, it just doesn't seem to be. Do we... You know, I thought that under Biden's administration, I thought that there would be, well, that he would fix the economy or do something to that effect. But I thought he was going to employ people, but people are not being employed. So all the money that's being distributed is going to make people dependent at the end of the day. They still don't have a job. What's so difficult when our infrastructure is not functioning, our roads are no good, our bridges are no good, everything is falling apart, we don't have the technological, fast trains, they're doing 200 miles an hour, we don't have anything like that at all, even what is it, the Amtrak on the East Coast, that's not really all that fast. And
well, part of the problem with the infrastructure,
it makes no sense.
Well, again, if you want to create jobs, you have to have a real investment in infrastructure. You're not going to get that investment if you can't get a consensus with the Republican Party. So that's part of the problem.
Uh-huh.
The other part of the problem is that, you know, a lot of these for big projects like rail lines and new highway construction, basically it involves partnerships with the state to go along with it. So if you say we're going to appropriate X billions of dollars or trillions of dollars for infrastructure projects, it's often the case that states do have to contribute a percentage of the cost, and maybe a number of states may not want to do that. We had in the previous Democratic administration, when Chris Christie was governor and Barack Obama was president, the state of New Jersey was offered billions of dollars to develop a high-speed light rail line. And Chris Christie said, well, I don't want the money because I'd have to spend New Jersey money on that. I'd rather spend that money on fixing potholes.
Uh-huh.
So that was the end of that.
I didn't remember that. Okay, it went over my head. So I didn't realize that that's part of the complexity. So the federal government would work with the state government and so on and so forth. So everyone's got to throw something into the pot.
that's often the case. So we don't really know what this particular infrastructure package would look like at the moment.
Mm-hmm. Under Roosevelt, there was an infusion and a recognition that something needed to be done to get the country back to work. So how did he succeed and we're not succeeding now? What's the difference? Do we know?
He had majorities in both chambers. That certainly helps. He also had opposition from the southern wing of the Democratic Party that did not want massive amounts of federal spending because they view it as another version of carpet bagging. He was able to get some of these programs through, but at a heavy cost. And the heavy cost is, and it's basically, and this is something which upset his wife greatly, was that he had to forsake a civil rights component to it.
Mm-hmm.
Basically,
yeah.
The southern states said, we will not tolerate it. Maybe we'll tolerate some of this New Deal stuff, but not if you include benefits to blacks. So some of the benefits were limited in many cases, precisely because there was strong opposition from Southern Democratic senators who actually controlled the Senate, because the Senate was based on a seniority system. The longer you're in, the more power you had. Since the South was essentially a one-party region, the Southern states basically controlled the Senate.
So are we stuck now? Are we just like in a rut as a nation because of the divide in the Senate? Maybe that's one of the reasons, this talk of making Puerto Rico a state and also the Washington, D.C. a state in order to be able to add four more Senate seats to the equation, which would make it a much softer cushion for the Democratic leadership at the moment, because now it's one vote that will make a difference, and that's Kamala Harris. So are we going the right way, or are we just fooling ourselves that this is functioning? Because it doesn't look like we are.
I think there's no guarantee that if you admitted Puerto Rico as a state, not that Puerto Rico hasn't wanted to be a state, but if you did so, there's no guarantee that Puerto Rico would be Democratic. It could be Republican for all we know. We don't really have the answer to that. As far as admitting Washington, D.C. as a state, there are some issues with that, because the territory was basically created from land from both Virginia and Maryland. Arguably, you could say to the residents of D.C., okay, depending on what side of Washington you live on, you either vote for senators in Maryland or senators in Virginia. So there is precedent for that kind of thing. And the other thing is, it's not clear that you can actually admit a state unless you actually have 60 votes to do it in the Senate. So it's not clear that you have enough to do that. So they can talk all they want. I think the real issue here is you have a couple of holdouts saying we will not end the filibuster, and as long as the filibuster is not ended, then the progressive left cannot accomplish its agenda.
Mm-hmm. So, and you've also pointed out in past essays about the minimum wage, which could be a floor. And yet that doesn't seem to be everywhere, does it? It's not in every state that there's a minimum wage, and then sometimes a minimum wage is not even a livable wage. Where do we go with that, and why is there an aversion to having a minimum wage? I used to hear when they were talking about even raising a minimum wage in New York City, they said, well, a lot of people couldn't function if they would have a salesperson at a telephone, cell phone store, that sort of thing. They said they couldn't afford to hire people. And was that logical? that they couldn't afford to hire people at a dollar more an hour?
So they can't afford to hire.
Rate was?
So they can't afford to hire people if the state mandates a higher minimum wage, but they can afford to hire people if there's a shortage of workers and that naturally drives up wages. I mean,
no,
that's sort of illogic to that, but that's often what they seem to be saying.
Yes.
The reality is that they're afraid of raising the minimum wage because they know they're going to have to raise the wages of people, other workers in wage ranges around the minimum wage. That's their concern. They don't want to come out and say that. Very few times do they actually say it, although sometimes various chambers of commerce will admit as much. But that's really the issue.
So what's the aversion to that? I don't know what the minimum wage is, let's say, in New York City. I don't know what the minimum wage is there, but whatever it is, why would that cause such rancor? I don't know if the people who work at a supermarket, I don't know what they get an hour, but would it matter if you pay them a dollar more or even $2 more? Aren't they going to have more money to spend as well? Aren't they going to?
Presumably they would have more money to spend, but the argument for not paying them higher wages is eating the profits.
Uh-huh.
Either that or you have to raise prices.
In other words, raise prices
to your profits.
Well, so that's right. You pointed out once that the cost of a burger, if you charged another, what is it? Was it a penny or was it 4 cents, whatever, 5 cents on a burger? People are still going to buy them, and you could pay the workers more. But you also pointed out that the profit margin would be lessened. Are we making too much money? Is business making too much money? But they have a right to. They've got the jobs, right?
They have a right to. They make the investments. They're entitled to a return on their investment. But, you know, they should be willing to pay the cost of labor for producing things. Otherwise, without workers, they wouldn't have a profit at all.
But we don't have a mechanism, do we? At one time, we had unions that were powerful, so there was a mechanism to fight back. But now without unions or with unions who've lost a tremendous amount of power and juice and relevance, and there was no one on the other side of a big corporation that could hire people. And is there anyone that would say, okay, you know what, it's just not worth it. We'll all go on strike for a week. That doesn't seem likely.
It's not likely, especially if you're talking about low-wage workers, and if they're not organized to begin with, and they don't have strike funds to partially compensate the striking workers,
right.
It's not going to happen. The other issue is that, you know, we're talking about, at least in the fast food industry, you're talking about a franchise operation. So unless you're willing, able to organize workers on an industry-wide basis, a strike is not really possible.
No. So at the end, it seems that the worker is really at the short end of the stick. It's not. We're just not elevating the low-end worker, and then. Who pays for this disheveled operation that we have? And I guess it's a problem all over the world. But does it fall on the back of the middle class all the time to salvage all these issues?
Well, that's essentially what has been happening. I mean, the worker has always received the short end of the stick, and the costs are borne on disproportionately by the middle class who disproportionately bear the brunt of higher taxes. So if you say, well, we'll address the issue of the fact that the workers are getting short end of the stick by offering the worker more programs, then we're going to be paying for those programs, including those workers that still have their jobs. even on their lousy wages. That's the reality. Now it then becomes a sort of, you know, cat and mouse game with various people in the left, especially the elites, who basically say, let's deflect attention from the fact that the workers are getting the short end of the stick, because due to the various economic policies that we are pursuing, which have been, you know, informed by mainstream economic thinking, will deflect attention by focusing on other issues like, you know, identity politics, critical race theory, and other things which have nothing to do with the economy, but, you know, it basically can show that we're moving towards a more morals just society.
Mm-hmm. Which it only seems that way. It's all verbal. I haven't seen that. So then what's floating our governments of late, maybe the last 25 years? What is it, just promises with unkept promises? And you know, we're voting. Are we voting because one is on one side of the equation, the other is on another side of the equation? And to what end? We're not getting anywhere, it seems. It seems we've been floundering the last 25 years that I'm familiar with.
Well, we basically recycle the same policies we've been recycling for the past 50, 60 years. Nothing has changed. And I think part of the problem is we're still operating within this particular neoclassical economic mindset. All our answers can be found there, as opposed to taking the more institutional economics approach, which basically recognizes that basically employers have power. The larger your corporate enterprise is, the more power that you have. You know, Jeff Bezos has a lot of power, and he can wield tremendous power because he's a multi-billionaire, the same as George Soros, George Soros and a few other people. It may appear to be that they are philanthropists, and that makes them feel good. It assuages them their guilt for achieving their wealth through leveraged buyouts and hurting workers along the way. The end result is they do have power. I mean, look at Amazon. Amazon, here you have the owner who proclaims to be a progressive. That's very nice. But he basically did everything he could to prevent unionization of Amazon plants.
Yeah, absolutely. And he's paying low wages and very long hours. It doesn't seem like it's a good place to work. But again, people need to work, and they'll accept it. And he seems to be gobbling up everything. But whatever happened to not permitting companies to get so big that they control such a large marketplace?
Well,
he's undercutting everything price-wise.
That's the argument for enforcing antitrust laws. So companies don't get to be that big. They don't operate in restraints of free trade. There's no competitor to Amazon at the moment. So Amazon can basically do what it wants. And since it becomes a principal employer of even of workers who are, while they're not earning the minimum wage, but they're earning above that, even workers who are earning that particular wage range, and they will put up with the miserable working conditions they have there, because they have to eat. They're afraid that if they lose the Amazon job, which may be paying $15 an hour, maybe paying $13 an hour, that whatever they take as an alternative will be paying less.
That's right. And so whatever happened to our, you know, deregulation, where we didn't permit companies to get so large so that they are onerous in their impact on the economy, and they don't pay very well either in comparison to what you would think would be a normal rate?
Because there was a revolution in the thinking, antitrust thinking, particularly during the 60s and 70s. largely due to the influence of the writings of Robert Bork at the time, who basically wrote that, okay, so monopolies, while they do operate between a free trade, we might be able to tolerate them if they are satisfying the interests of consumers through low prices. So in other words, you know, we can put up with the Walmarts of the world because the Walmarts of the world offer cheap goods and services to a large percentage of the population. Never mind the fact that they are hurting workers, but they are offering cheap goods to various people. So we like, consumers like cheap goods, therefore we can tolerate the Walmarts, by extension, we can tolerate the Amazon too.
Yeah, but isn't that what got us into this mess? Actually, by, you know, importing a lot of stuff that was less expensive, and I guess it's free trade, but it undermined our workers, and undermined our economy, and undermined our capacity to employ. At the end, it seems like a failed system. Because we lost a lot of companies. They went abroad because it was cheaper there. We lost a lot of technology because it went abroad. It was cheaper somewhere else. How do you fight this back? Because it looks like we're on the losing end.
We seem to double down and basically say, well, the reason why we're seeing failure is because we moved away from those policies. I mean, it's sort of like, you know, in foreign policy right now, Iran is emboldened because we moved away from the Iran nuclear deal. We can't bring ourselves to recognize it was a failed deal. It was a bad deal to begin with. So we just doubled down and we say, no, if we had not left the nuclear pact, then of course Iran would be more well behaved. Well, I think most people know that's nonsense, but that's human nature. Because, again, you can't bring yourself to admit that the previous administration may have been correct and that the administration before that may have actually made a mistake.
Can you imagine? We have a lot of that going on.
Can you imagine if Joe Biden had run on the platform and said, I realize now that the previous administration, which I was part of, made a big mistake with this, and I want to try to correct that by seriously having a better deal. But he wouldn't do that.
Yeah. Is that human nature to not be able to admit that someone made a mistake, and that there is a requirement for corrective action? And we're not talking about, you know, doing something in your personal life, but we're talking about an economy that seems to be faltering. Our infrastructure is falling apart. People are not really earning a good enough living, and now we're trying to get money from the well-to-do, and they're not paying the taxes anyway. And then we're subsidizing so much of our workers, and that comes right out of our taxpayers' money. Who's going to pay for that, the earned income tax credit? Are we becoming a welfare state?
Well, we may be becoming a welfare state, though we're increasing the welfare budget, and we may be creating more dependency. We don't, again, time will tell. We don't really know, have the answer to that. I mean, it's possible in the short term, which you will see, with massive amounts of public spending, you will see a boom in employment for the short term. But the problem is, at some point, you are going to have to slow the economy by raising taxes to pay for all this debt. And nobody wants to own up to that.
Well, I think we discussed this before. China has already threatened the United States and say, well, we have your bonds. We may call it in. If they call it in, I don't know what America can do other than to pay it off. That's going to be a real shock to our economy, isn't it? We owe so much money abroad. And they have our debt. They can ruin us, can't they? Or do we say, the hell with it, we're not going to pay?
Well, I suppose we could do that. The 14th Amendment to the Constitution says we have to make good on all our our obligations. So so there's an issue with that. But I suppose, you know, if we don't want to pay off our debt to the Chinese, I mean, what are they going to do? Go to war with us?
Yeah, exactly. I don't think they would go that far. So where do we go from here? Or are we simply stuck in our old ways without reflecting on what was? We still promise people all kinds of things, the rhetoric and so on, and we try to make believe that the consumer is getting a better deal because we permit it. And at the end, though, the worker is just not even earning enough money to buy some of the products that are supposedly cheaper. It's not the same quality of product as well either, not in all cases. And then even why are we permitting all our technology to get blown out the door? If we're investing so much money in China, they have easy access to steal our stuff from there. I mean, I'm still in shock that Apple is operating out of there. They're copying all that technology. Those are Chinese companies that are putting it together. I don't understand where our survival comes in on these sort of issues.
Part of it is we invest in Chinese plants because wage rates are so much lower. The other part of it is we invest in Chinese plants because we want to have access to the Chinese market and sell our goods and services to the Chinese. So that's what a lot of companies do. But again, if you are talking about a national security concern, and nobody seems to be addressing this in terms of national security, then there is this whole question. The more debt that we run up, to pay for various programs of the progressive wish list, and the more debt the Chinese purchase, then they do have us over a barrel, and that does become a national security threat. And so what do? We basically respond by saying, oh, the Chinese aren't so terrible. Oh, we'll overlook the human rights abuses. Oh, we'll overlook this and overlook that. We'll even overlook the possibility that maybe there could have been a laboratory, failure here, and basically the virus basically fell out of was enhanced in a lab and escaped the lab. We'll overlook that too because we what are we going to do? We're not going to go to war with nuclear power under any circumstances.
So is there any solution for our economy the way it is right now? It doesn't seem to be functioning on all cylinders. It just seems like we're going on one or two when we should be able to go full steam ahead at this moment. Since we're printing the money anyway, why aren't we investing in infrastructure? Why are we investing it in a different way? Because if you don't have any money, then you spend it right away. I don't know if this works anymore, to be honest.
Well, the President of the United States is not empowered to invest in infrastructure through executive action. To spend public money, he must get an act of Congress to do so. So that Congress has the power of the purse. So if you're going to have an infrastructure policy, there has to be an agreement. There has to be consensus in the halls of Congress. I mean, there has to be agreement between Republicans and Democrats. Until that happens, there's not going to be any infrastructure spending. I think, the truth is the Democrats could do a better job of trying to protect the workers and take some smaller steps as opposed to increasing federal spending on massive programs, which probably are not going to be terribly successful and in many ways are a bridge to nowhere. I think we should be spending more, they should be more concerned with appointment to the National Labor Relations Board, so in the hopes that you get more rulings which are favorable to workers and less favorable to business interests, they should be more concerned with Supreme Court appointments who, in terms of their record on labor issues, as opposed to their records on abortion rights. Abortion rights are pretty much protected by precedent at this point. So we stop making a big deal out of that and be more concerned about protecting the rights of workers. We should be more concerned with having some kind of legitimate wage policy that ensures that business workers' wages will go up, but also the workers can achieve some measure of bargaining power, because they are on the losing end of this asymmetrical power imbalance between labor and business. And lastly, the Democrats should be in favor of enforcing antitrust laws to break up big business, in order so you can achieve more competition, which would also have a beneficial impact on natural wage growth. So these are little things that the Democratic Party could do if they really cared about workers. I'm not convinced they do anymore. But if they did, these are the kinds of steps the Democrats in Washington would in fact take.
Well, I guess that's all very interesting. So at the same time, though, are we moving to make any corrections? It seems that we're consolidating more power in fewer businesses. Look at what's going on with the movie industry. It seems every company under the sun is getting into the streaming business. That's great. Maybe that's an outcome of the pandemic to a great extent, but it's going to be on the platform. That's not going away, and yet the biggest companies in the world are involved in that. So there's nothing new under the sun. It's just that more and more businesses are consolidating their power and their prowess. Does that work for us as a society?
I don't think so, because I think big business, big government needs big business, and vice versa. And when you're talking about small government, you really are talking about many more small businesses. And I think that's inimical to the idea of big government, big business. That's where we're headed. But again, if you allow big business to basically determine wage rates, and you don't support a counterbalance to that, whether it's unions or you basically have a government acting as the empire in terms of negotiating wage rates for various sectors of the economy, which is more of a corporatist model that you find in many European countries, then the workers, again, continue to get the short end of the stick. And then, the Democratic Party comes back and says, but we do care about our workers, but we're giving them programs.
Is there any solution that the government can do to actually change the dynamics so that people can earn a living and at the same time there's an incentive for a big business to conduct themselves in a different way? I mean, where do we go? Or are we stymied by our political system?
Well, one of the things I suggested was, again, if you're going to use the tax code for social engineering, then let's do it right. I don't really believe it should be used for social engineering. It should be about nothing more than revenue raising. But if you're going to do that, and you really think that, okay, we're not competitive with a high capital gains tax, then basically say to corporations, we'll lower the capital gains tax on the condition that you raise your workers' wages. You pay your workers above a certain threshold. If your failure to do that means that you will not get that capital gains tax cut, you'll be paying a higher capital gains tax. That probably would have a greater impact on the lives of most workers than any number of federal programs.
Wow. And so why aren't we moving in that direction? Or is it Or would it expose the fact that we're really not interested in the worker?
Well, it certainly exposes the fact we're not interested in the worker, but business interests have lobbyists to prevent that from happening.
Uh-huh. So it does seem that government is really not as powerful as we used to think, since they control less and less all the time. But then they got us here, didn't they?
I mean, I think government is as able as those who contribute to campaigns allow it to be.
Yeah. Well, so that's usually on the higher end of the socioeconomic ladder, of which I'm certainly not one. But, you know, I think most people would fall into that. I don't know how many big businesses and wealthy people literally control our economy, but I'm sure there are not even 1,000 of them, you know, that are really worth a fortune, and they have the capacity to direct government in one direction or another through their lobbyists. So those are probably the most powerful people in the nation, the lobbyists. And the worker doesn't get anything out of it.
They only get something out of it if they have the ability to hire their own lobbyists, which they don't. But that's part of the problem with big labor these days. They do spend money on lobbyists. They spend more on lobbyists than they spend on organizing activity for more workers.
Mm-hmm. And why aren't the unions trying to get more lobbyists to promote their agenda, which would benefit the worker? Or is that also a falsehood?
It's a vicious circle. In order to have the money to hire big lobbyists, you have to have a membership base. So if the union membership is declining for a variety of different reasons, your budget for lobbying activities is basically going to decline. The idea here is to lobby for policies which are beneficial to the interests of labor.
Mm-hmm. And then if we can't do it on an individual union basis, why isn't there a union movement to collectively get, you know, lobbyists to promote like businesses? Or basically, maybe it doesn't have to be auto workers alone. Maybe it could be, people in the aeronautics business. Isn't there something that actually would comply in generalities with all the union workers? Isn't there like a baseline that we could function on that isn't specifically aeronautics only or automobile industry only? Or fast food workers only? Isn't there something that traverses all of those different unions, if they are any? What do you think?
Well, the union that basically subsumed all was the American Federation of Labor and Congress of Industrial Organizations, AFL-CIO. The AFL-CIO has sort of been eclipsed by public sector unions whereby we've seen a growth in public sector union membership. We've seen a decline in private sector union membership. And then, of course, you've had no union activity with regards to low-wage labor market, certainly not in the fast food industry. And attempts to organize Walmart workers has been met with basically literally shutdowns of individual Walmart stores as a message to workers in other Walmart stores not to even attempt such activity.
Wow. That's amazing. So, I mean, it's got to be very, very big for Walmart to shut down a few stores in order to warn people that they have absolutely no power whatsoever and that there is a difference between those that have and those that are in need of a job. So big business and the worker, it's not an equal footing, is it?
Well, I mean, you're seeing the power imbalance in action.
Yeah. So where do we go from here? Or are we now stuck in this morass of our own making, which has probably all been promoted anyway through lobbyists who promoted one sort of dynamic? And why didn't we see this coming? Well, maybe you probably noticed it, but certainly people like me who were not that well connected to knowing what's going on that way are totally unaware. And political parties aren't talking that much about it.
We've seen it coming, and we've been aware of it for decades now. But, why would the political parties want to talk about it? Because they derive benefit from these arrangements. They need money to run campaigns. Individual members of Congress need money to run campaigns. They're not going to upset the unions and the political action committees that contribute money to their campaigns. But they will talk about, quote, corporate interests. It's basically an amorphous term, corporate interests. It's an abstraction of corporate power and so on and so forth. You sound like Bernie Sanders, but you're not going to actually assail the actual corporations that contribute to your campaigns. Never happens.
It's a fine line. Do people understand that it's a very fine line? Or does it go over our heads?
I think it goes over some people's heads, I imagine. Really? Other people are just too bogged down in trying to make a living to really care or even give any consideration to these issues at all.
What about the conclusion in your essay? Would that work? Can we get to that point where there is a solution that would incentivize big business to do better for the worker and or not? And that would become their own choosing. How do we get them to move?
Well, again, to do that requires a willingness to use the tax code in such a way as to make it costly for business to harm the interests of workers. And to get that kind of consensus is near impossible. You can see what it's like every time we talk about some kind of tax reform. It's unachievable, it's unobtainable. We can't even have a simple tax reform whereby we basically say we'll simply eliminate all deductions and just simply have very low tax rates. We can't even do that because businesses, for whatever reason, they seem to like the fact that they get all these deductions for various activities. But we're not using these deductions in a way that serves the interests of society, and especially not the interests of workers. We could. Mm-hmm. We should. But nobody has really run on a campaign thus far of doing just that. They talk this wonderful game of, oh, I'm going to stick it to the union, to the business interests. I'm going to make them pay their fair share. I'm going to raise corporate taxes and things like that. Fine. You want to raise corporate taxes, you're raising the prices for everybody. That's the problem with corporate taxes. You know, you think that you're making the corporations pay for something, they're not paying for anything. If you raise their taxes, they pass the tax on to the consumer in the form of higher prices. So we're all paying for it in the name of justice.
Wow. So we are where we are. So it doesn't look like we're moving. Is that because of the political stalemate? But somehow or another, even though there's a divide between our two different major parties, they seem to be aligned when it comes to not having a solution that they could both agree on. And why is there no desire to find that solution? It's not that difficult. These are not stupid people. They probably know more about economics than most people, you would think.
I'm not convinced that members of Congress know too much about economics. There's some of the things they do, and maybe some of their staffers know a little bit, but I'm not convinced that most of them do. If, as it's become rather evident, especially looking at people like AOC, she clearly knows nothing about economics. She knows the slogans in Marx's political thought, but she doesn't really understand what Marx really had to say.
No, that's very true. I don't know, how long has she been in office? What is it, a year and a half or something like that? She lives in one of the wealthiest, places in the Washington, D.C. area. So she's making a fortune of money somehow. But the people she represents are not, which is amazing. So it goes. Well, Professor, as usual, it's always a pleasure, always a learning experience for me, and thank you for sharing it with our audience. Hopefully, people will read the article that you wrote, because it explains it so well. So, thank you very much. All the best to you. Stay healthy.
Thank you.
Thank you. Bye. Well, there we have it, folks. Orrin M. Levin Waldman, socioeconomic research scholar. And I find him totally brilliant in every level. Certainly, I don't have knowledge that he does. And it really is magnanimous of him to share it, because I think it's one of the most crucial aspects of any function in government. Bear with me one moment. I need to look at the. I need to look at the calendar here, because I'm not quite sure. I did check the Mayor Sean Patterson Howard of Mount Vernon. She will be calling us today, and I just wanted to make sure that I remember the time slot. Bear with me a moment. She'll be coming on at 11:30. So I guess it's time for me to tell you a little bit more about the professor. So let's go over there and cover some of his work. Extremely accomplished, as you can imagine. He's written quite a few works. He's the author of Restoring the Middle Class Through Wage Policy. Those are Arguments for Middle Class, published by Palgrave, P-A-L-G-R-A-V-E. Then you've got Understanding Public Policy in the United States, again by Orrin M. Levin Waldman. And this is published by Top Hat, T-O-P-H-A-T. Then this is how I got introduced to him. There was a book called The Minimum Wage, A Reference Handbook, that he wrote. This is published by ABC-CLIO, C-L-I-O. So ABC-CLIO. And then in paperback, a wonderful work called Wage Policy, Income Distribution, and Democratic Theory, again written by Orrin M. Levin Waldman. And this one is published by Routledge, R-O-U-T-L-E-D-G-E, Routledge. And the last one, of course, is The Case of the Minimum Wage. And this one is published by the State University of New York Press. And you could find it there. Now, you must know that Orrin M. Levin Waldman is a faculty member in the School of Public Affairs and Administration at Rutgers University, based in Newark. And he's a socioeconomic research scholar at Global Institute for Sustainable Prosperity Research. You could find him on his own website at www.econlabor.com. So www.econlabor.com. The website address where you could find him is Labor, but you have to look it up. The name, the website's called Labor Econ, but the web address is econlabor.com. And you can reach out, of course, to his office. He's at 914-629-6351. And that's pretty much it. So hopefully you'll be able to read his latest essay. I see I had so many calls last night, and I see that I'd forgotten to put in under the article or the essay that he wrote, which is Mainstream Economics Too Often Ignores the Power Imbalance in Labor Markets by Oren M. Levin-Waldman. I forgot to post the information that people could also listen to the radio broadcast should they so choose. So after 12 today, when I finish the broadcast, I'll go back to fix that. All right, so let's look and see what else is going on the world stage and first hyperlocal stage as well. So bear with me here while I find that. One second. There's a great article written by Bob Weir called What Happened to Racial and Ethnic Humor, which is harks back to the olden days, and you might be interested in that. Then there's an article written by Paul Finer, the supervisor of Greenberg, and it's about the Gulata House, who donated a lift for a housing authority tenant unable to travel outside of her house due to her illness and the steps that she would need to climb up and down. And yet with Gulata, I think it's pronounced that Gulata or Gulata House, they were able to get funding for a stair elevator of some sort that can traverse those steps. And it's absolutely brilliant that they would have done that, and what an investment on their part. And it's just wonderful that there are people who have the capacity and have the interest to help. That isn't always the case, and very, very interesting. In case you haven't noticed, tomorrow is a Legislation and Codes Committee meeting. It will take place on Thursday, June 3rd at 10 o'clock in the morning. So the majority leader, Corazon Pineda Isaac, advised that there will be a Legislation and Codes Committee meeting, which she heads. And it will take place at 10 o'clock in the morning on June 3rd, that's tomorrow. And she'll be looking into creating a law, a local law, creating a new Chapter 38 of the codes of the Code of the City of Yonkers entitled Hotel Licensing. Another will be any additional items that may properly come before the committee. And the people that are involved in this particular committee, of course, Corazon Pineda Isaac, she's the chair, Mike Cater, the council president, Tasha Diaz of District 3, John Rubo of District 4, Anthony Moranti of District 6. And just so you're aware, we got this information from Narissa Di Pena. She's the second deputy city clerk of the city of Yonkers. And there's information in case you need to reach her office. Her office number is there at 914-377-6020. And so this will be very interesting to hear. And again, the Legislation and Codes Committee meeting has been scheduled for tomorrow, June 3rd at 10 a.m., and it's going to be conducted by a WebEx. So the link to the WebEx is all there, and that's where it is. So, okay, let's move on to some other things. Bear with me a moment. Okay. All right. Let me quickly look to see what else is happening. I think we'll be able to do Sean Patterson Howard coming on at 11:30. it's best that we go immediately into the national stage and international stage. And this is very interesting because we're still going through a major process of getting a leadership in Israel. So it seems that the dreams of the father are guiding a candidate, Yair Lapid, as he eyes Israel's premiership. Yair Lapid, like his late father, is a journalist turned politician renowned for his staunchly secular position. But as the centrist politician edges towards the Israeli premiership post, he stepped out of his father's shadow. Back in the day when he was disseminating the news instead of making it, Yair Lapid had a standard final question on his weekly chat show on Israel's Channel 2. And his question was, what symbolizes Israel for you? The handsome TV host would ask his guest. And the answers were often long-winded, ranging from lighthearted to heartfelt. But when the leading journalist had his own father, former Israeli Prime Minister Joseph, also known as Tommy Lapid, on the show, the answer was illuminating. When the son asked the father what, in his view, represented Israel, the senior Lapid simply replied, "You." Well, the dreams of the father could well be coming true years after his death from cancer. On Sunday, May 29, after weeks of intense backroom negotiations, Lapid secured the support of kingmaker, nationalist hardliner Naftali Bennett to form a coalition government that would oust Israel's longest-serving leader, Prime Minister Benjamin Netanyahu. Under a rotating post agreement, the two men would split the premiership, with Bennett serving the first 2 years and Lapid the following two. Premiership agreement was similar to a deal Lapid struck with centrist Israeli politician Benny Gantz ahead of the September 2019 legislative elections. But that plan was never put to the test since Gantz switched sides to join Netanyahu's government, and yet another display of the dizzying machinations that have forced Israel to hold four inconclusive elections in 2 years. The latest election on March 23rd saw Lapid's party, Yesh Atid, There Is a Future is what it means, come second with 17 seats in Israel's 120-member parliament, the Knesset itself. And following Netanyahu's failure to form a government, Lapid was assigned the task by the country's figurehead president. In a country where the prime minister faces serious corruption charges but has refused to step down during the trial, and where politicians flip sides with little regard for ideological inconsistency, Lapid has stood firm on central issues. So we'll have to see where all that goes. It's going to be very, very compelling to see where it does move to. Now, let's just look at a couple of other things on the world stage. One second. Let me see. This is really very, very interesting. A Kazakh by the name of Lutsenko is closing in on Postelberger after Astana on a 1-2. This you may not have heard of. A Kazakh by the name of Alexei Lutsenko led Spaniard Ian Izaguirre in an Astana 1-2 in Wednesday's fourth stage of the Criterium du Dauphin, a 16.4-kilometer time trial between Firminy and Roche-la-Molière. Well, Austrian Lukas Postelberger, who rides for Bora, kept hold of the race leader's yellow and blue jersey, but Lutsenko cut his lead to just 1 second. Britain's Ineos rider, Geraint Thomas, winner of the 2018 Tour de France, was leading halfway through the course but slowed down in the second, more demanding half. The Welshman eventually finished, like Postelberga, 23 seconds off Lutsenko's winning time. Thursday's fifth stage is a 175.4-kilometer ride from Saint-Chamond to Saint-Vallier, featuring a steep climb, 12 kilometers, from the finish that will complicate affairs for the sprinters. So this is a very, very interesting race. And if you've got the capacity to see it on a video, it would be a phenomenal. Now, 1 second here. Okay. And this is very interesting in Africa. The African Union has announced that there will be an immediate suspension, quote-unquote, of Mali after a second coup in the African nation. So the African Union has suspended Mali's membership in response to last week's military coup and threatened sanctions if a civilian-led government is not restored, it said in a statement yesterday. The African Union decides to immediately suspend the Republic of Mali from participation in all activities of the African Union, its organs and institutions, until normal constitutional order has been restored in the country. Well, the body's Peace and Security Council said in a statement late on Tuesday, well, the military arrested interim president Ba Ndaw and Prime Minister Mukhtar Owan last week and pressured them to resign, derailing a transition to democratic elections after another military coup last August ousted the previous administration. Well, former Vice President Assimi Goïta, a colonel who led the August coup and last week's revolt, was declared president on Friday. Well, the African Union called for, quote, an unimpeded, transparent and swift return to the civilian-led transition, failing which the Council will not hesitate to impose targeted sanctions, the African Union's Peace and Security Council had said. Well, Mali's neighbors and international powers fear the latest revolt will jeopardize a commitment to hold a presidential election in February and undermine a regional fight against Islamist militants, some of whom are based in Mali's desert north. Well, the West African Regional Bloc, ECOWAS, ECOWAS, suspended Mali on Sunday. The African Union suspended Mali after last August, but reinstated the country a few weeks later after the heads of the African of the new civilian-led transitional government were announced. So we'll have to see where that goes. Okay. Bear with me a moment as we move forward. This is very interesting as well. A lot of stuff is going on in Israel with the new election. Isaac Herzog, a veteran, a politician, and the scion of a prominent Israeli family, was elected president yesterday, a largely ceremonial role that is meant to serve as the nation's moral compass and promote unity. Well, the anonymous vote was held among the 120 members of the Knesset or parliament. Herzog will be Israel's 11th president, succeeding Reuven Rivlin, who is set to leave office next month after 7 years in office. Herzog, who is 60, is a former head of Israel's Labor Party and opposition leader who unsuccessfully ran against Prime Minister Benjamin Netanyahu and in the 2001 parliamentary elections. He is scion of a prominent Zionist family. His father, Chaim Herzog, was Israel's ambassador to the United Nations before being elected president. His uncle, Abba Iban, was Israel's first foreign minister and ambassador to the United Nations and United States. His grandfather was the country's first chief rabbi, and Herzog defeated Miriam Peretz, an educator who was seen as a down-to-earth outsider. She was also seen as closer to the government, to the country's dominant conservative and nationalist political camp. Well, Herzog has served as head of the Jewish Agency, a nonprofit that works closely with the government to promote immigration to Israel. And for the past 3 years since resigning from parliament, and he was widely seen as a favorite because of his deep ties to the political establishment, he will hold office for a single 7-year term starting July 9. Well, the president, while largely a ceremonial head of state, is tasked with tapping a political party leader to form governing coalitions after parliamentary elections. And Israel has held 4 national elections in the past 2 years amid a protracted political crisis. Netanyahu's opponents face a midnight deadline on Wednesday, that's tonight, to put together coalition guideline or government. And if they fail, the country could be plunged into another elections campaign. Well, the president also has the power to grant pardons, creating a potentially sensitive situation as Netanyahu stands trial for a series of corruption charges. We'll have to see where that all goes. Bear with me a moment as we move forward. Okay. Bear with me a second here. Yeah, and this is what you need to know. With all the stuff that we've been talking about with regard to Israel, the Israeli opposition politicians are in a race against the clock to unseat Netanyahu. Israeli politicians are battling to unseat the veteran right-wing Prime Minister Benjamin Netanyahu, were locked in last-ditch talks on Wednesday to hammer out their change coalition composed of bitter ideological rivals. Netanyahu's opponents have until the end of the day at 20:59 Greenwich Mean Time. Let me see, it's a 7-hour time difference between us and Israel. So it's now about 11. Let's say for the sake of argument, it's 12 o'clock here, and it would be 7 o'clock there. They're about, 7 o'clock. So it would be 2 hours left over. It's almost just under 3 hours before the deadline will be met. I'll be too late to advise you on radio, but there'll be an answer in about 3 hours' time, a little bit less than 3 hours, if Netanyahu has been able to hold on to government. So that's going to be very, very compelling. And 1 second. And this was interesting yesterday. Biden honored black victims of the Tulsa race massacre, which took place 100 years ago. So Joe Biden on Tuesday became the first sitting U.S. president to visit the Tulsa, Oklahoma site where hundreds of black people were massacred by a white mob in 1921. As he marked the country's legacy of racial violence. Biden oversaw a moment of silence for the victims after meeting with 3 people who lived in the district during the massacre, Viola Fletcher, Hughes Von Ellis, and Leslie Benningfield Randy, and toured a museum dedicated to the incident. I came here to help the silence between, to fill the silence between the silent wounds as they deepen. Biden told an audience that included survivors of the Tulsa race massacre and their families. My fellow Americans, the president said, this was not a riot. This was a massacre and among the worst in our history, but not the only one. His administration also planned to take steps to combat inequality. They include efforts to expand federal contracting with small disadvantaged businesses, invest tens of billions of dollars in communities like Greenwood that suffer from persistent poverty, and pursue new efforts to combat housing discrimination. Now, between the ages of 101 and 107, survivors who met with Biden asked Congress for justice, quote unquote, this year, and are parties to a lawsuit against state and local officials seeking several remedies for the massacre, including a victim compensation fund. What these survivors have endured is tragic and devastating. White House spokeswoman Karine Jean-Pierre told reporters on the flight to Oklahoma on Tuesday. But Biden did not answer a reporter's question about whether there should be an official U.S. presidential apology for the incident in which as many as 300 people were killed. His spokeswoman did not say whether the president would discuss whether reparations should be paid to the descendants of people who were affected. And Biden plans to address the U.S. legacy of racist violence and the challenges to unity ahead, an administration official said. Biden cannot fulfill his promise to restore the soul of the nation without recognizing the complexity of U.S. history, the official said. In a proclamation on, in a proclamation on Monday, Biden asked all Americans to reflect on the deep roots of racial terror in our nation and recommit to and working of rooting out systemic racism across the country. His suit comes during a racial reckoning in the United States as the country's white majority shrinks, threats increase from white supremacist groups, and the country reexamines its treatment of African Americans after last year's murder of George Floyd, a black man by a white Minneapolis police officer, who thereby sparked nationwide protests. Well, Biden, a Democrat who won the presidency partly on the strengths of wild bark, that's going to be very, very helpful. Okay. All right, so I think we're here. All right, we have just a couple of more minutes before the mayor comes on. This is very, very interesting. I never expected this. The United States says that a cyber attack on the world's largest meat packer is likely from Russia. The company is called JBS. It's based in Worthington Park. That's the plant. Brazil's JBS SA told the U.S. government that a ransomware attack on the company that disrupted meat production in North America and Australia originated from a criminal organization likely based in Russia, the White House said on Tuesday. JBS is the world's largest meat packer, said on Tuesday night it had made significant progress in resolving the cyber attack. The vast majority of the company's beef, pork, poultry, and prepared foods plants will be operational today, according to a statement easing concerns over rising food prices. Well, the cyber attack followed one last month by a group with ties to Russia on Colonial Pipeline, the largest fuel pipeline in the United States, which cripples fuel industry delivery for fuel delivery for several days in the U.S. Southeast. JBS halted cattle slaughter at all of its U.S. plants on Tuesday, according to union officials. And on Monday, the attack caused Australian operations to shut down. Our systems are coming back online, and we're not sparing any resources to fight this threat, said Andre Nogueira, the chief executive of JBS USA. Well, with North American operations headquartered in Greeley, Colorado, JBS controls about 20% of the slaughtering capacity for U.S. cattle and hogs. White House spokeswoman Karine Jean-Pierre and the White House One moment here, I lost my place. JBS sells beef and pork under the Swift brand, with retailers like Costco Wholesale Corp carrying its pork loins and tenderloins. JBS also owns most of the chicken processor Pilgrim's Pride Company, which sells organic chicken under the Just Bear brand. An ongoing shutdown of JBS plants would threaten to raise meat prices further for American consumers during summer grilling season and to disrupt meat exports at a time of strong demand from China. Well, the supply chains, logistics, and transportation that keep our society moving are essentially vulnerable to ransomware, where attacks on choke clients can have the outsized effects and encourage hasty payments. So that's one of the problems there. Looks like there'll be more ransom attacks all over the place. It's absolutely amazing. And what I'm going to do is I'm going to move on to our studio screen, because we're going to be expecting to hear from Sean Patterson Howard. Bear with me a moment. So I'm going to go back to the screen. 1 second. All right, 1 second here. Where is it now? Okay, here it is. Blog Talk. Do we have that down? I'm going to check one other thing. Do this and move to one other place. And a lot of pages I had to open, so forgive me for the delay. But we should be on time for the mayor and seat calls in just about a moment. Okay. All right, so we're going to, we don't need to introduce this yet. When the mayor comes on, we'll talk about the issues that are before us. And you may have heard that in Mount Vernon there was a decision by the Mount Vernon City Council to pass legislation which would have forbidden funds that are coming from the federal government to help municipalities. I don't know what the exact figure is, but the amount doesn't matter, but it's just that there is a large amount of millions of dollars coming into Mount Vernon. And there was a definition by the City Council of Mount Vernon to not permit the money to go directly to the comptroller. And yet There was a suit brought forward by Erickson Lawrence, who was running for comptroller. There was also a second suit that came from the present comptroller, Deborah Reynolds. And one second. So with Deborah Reynolds, she took out a second lawsuit to try to make sure that the monies would go directly to the comptroller's office. There were two cases brought before the Supreme Court in White Plains, and two different judges agreed that the conduct of the city council was inappropriate, and they're looking for just cause. They're looking for a resolution to that issue. And so the concern right now is still in abeyance until we find out what will happen. And I'm not exactly sure what the two judges in separate cases are demanding. And so the thing we'll be able to discuss with the mayor is the integrity of the suits and how that will impact the city and what may have been regarded as inappropriate by the conduct of the city council that was wanting as far as the two judges were concerned. Very, very interesting issue, and it still amazes me. So many years with the comptroller, who will not run for or seek additional office, but the concern now, I guess, is basically that the monies will arrive while Deborah Reynolds is still the comptroller. And then, so I don't exactly understand what it is that the city council thought they could do to bypass the comptroller and why that would be pertinent. So there are just a lot of issues here, and we'll eventually find out what the rationale is and get a better understanding of what's what. At the end of the day, I still think that the major issue needs to be for the city of Mount Vernon, which they probably will not be able to accomplish with the present comptroller, Deborah Reynolds. But when she's gone, whoever will be the new comptroller, the mayor has to move the bank from Chase, where it is now, to another bank, because they were the ones that broke the law by not permitting access and also abiding by directives from the comptroller with only one signature to the bank. And it's outlandish and it's probably not legal, but the demeanor of the city has yet to take the Chase to court over that conduct. And that happened under three administrations. The bank would still allow the comptroller to have one signature, not a dual electronic signature, which was required. They did that with Richard Thomas. They did that with Andre Wallace. And who was, there was a third one. Let me just think a second. Oh, and then, of course, was Sean Patterson Howard. And that was all under the time frame when Deborah Reynolds, the comptroller, was still at large, and she still is. She will not be stepping down until the last day of December of this year. And that's a long way off. So, and there's probably no way for the federal government to say, no problem, we'll hold off giving you payment until you resolve the issue with the comptroller over there, because I don't think they want to get involved in a lawsuit like this. So that's going to be very, very interesting and compelling. We'll have to see where that all goes. Really, really mind-blowing. Well, the mirror is delayed for some reason, so hopefully she'll be calling soon. In the meantime, let me just look at some other things. Bear with me a moment until she calls. We'll see what's what. One second. All right. Let's just see where else, what we have. No, I think we've caught up on the different articles that are on the front page. Oh, I didn't notice this to you. The Legislation and Codes Committee is having a meeting on Thursday. That's tomorrow at 10 o'clock in the morning. It's on behalf of Majority Leader Corazon Pineda Isaac. And they're going to request a local law creating a new Chapter 38 of the Code of the City of Yonkers entitled Hotel Licensing, and any other additional items that may properly come before that committee. So we'll see where that goes. And I see the mayor is on, so let's bring her in.
Hi,
good morning,
Heavy,
Mayor.
How
are you?
Good morning.
Oh,
how are you, my friend?
It's a pleasure to have you on. Thank God.
Pleasure
okay.
To be
well,
here.
I left. And I'm thrilled that you are here, and I hope all's well. Well, I think the most compelling thing that's come about was realized with two lawsuits, but they originated after the Mount Vernon City Council decided that they wanted that funding from the federal government not to go directly to the comptroller and to bypass the comptroller and I guess go directly to government. I don't know if it had to go directly to the city council or would go to your office as mayor. Wasn't sure, but there were two challenges to that. The first one was a candidate who was running for comptroller, Derrickson Barnes, and the case that he brought to the federal courthouse in White Plains was that the judge wanted clarity over it. Then there was a second case that came from the present comptroller, who's not running for re-election, Deborah Reynolds, and that too got the same sort of response from a second judge that wanted to understand the integrity of that sort of conduct, whether it was legal or not. How do you see that from a corporation counsel perspective? You know, if you could speak to that. And why did it happen
this? Why did it happen like this? Well, I mean, the comptroller's been in the office for 41 months. And for 41 months, she has not produced a single monthly, quarterly, or annual report. She has not closed the 2017, 18, 19, or 2020 books. She has not sent state reporting filing requirements to the New York State Comptroller. They did a policy and oversight audit, and they released that information in September. And in that, it stated that, again, what we've said, she hasn't provided reports. She hasn't provided information that we need to run the day-to-day business of the city. They've been doing another operation over internal control procedures, really, for the last year, and they haven't completed that. They haven't completed that audit because they continue to find more things, and at the same time, they have to continue to subpoena her for records that she has failed to provide. So I don't think that there's anyone right now who is not saying at one level or another. We've had federal judges that have had to, put in judgments and direct her to pay bills for our sewers, for our workers, for our vendors, so that we can be in compliance with a federal consent decree. There have been state judges and county judges that have had to so order her to pay bills for gas, for public safety and DPW and city vehicles. She is clearly incompetent. The problem is incompetence is not illegal, and a competence is not enough to remove a person from an office for those who have the power to do so. She is an elected controller, not an appointed controller, else she would have been gone already.
Right.
So we are stuck. The Mount Vernon City Charter is old, and it is a charter that does not address a lot of these issues. And so an old charter full of holes that you can drive trucks through makes it very easy for courts to side with her, even if they would not want to. They have to, you know, make their decisions, I guess, based on the charter, even though there is an abundance of information that demonstrates her failure to do her job. And so as the city council and the mayor, who are also responsible, who have fiduciary responsibilities to the citizens of Mount Vernon, took action to go around the system that has not been serving the community. And that was to put forth an ordinance and to go with a third-party administrator, which is totally legal based on the American Rescue Plan, to manage the funds. So, you know, this is a temporary restraining order. We will have our opportunity to make, you know, more full arguments in court. The money is not here, so there's nothing to hand over. And we're going to continue to go on and govern. I mean, this, you know, the American Rescue Plan monies are very important, but the entire system of financial functioning in Mount Vernon has corrooted to
disarray.
To disarray. And so, you know, I have called on the city council, and I'm doing it again formally, for them to do what for most people is unthinkable, and that's to ask for the state to come in with an emergency financial control review board. I mean, control board. That is the nuclear option, but, you know, at this time it's the only option. It's not about the fact that she'll be leaving office in 7 months. It's about the fact that the city of Mount Vernon's finances are in such disarray, and we don't even have an idea how bad they are. We just see that we're, you know, double-digit millions behind in our medical expenses, that bills are not being paid for critical services, that we have to call Yonkers for garbage trucks. We have to call the county for sewer bypass machines. We have to depend on New York City for fire engines. We have to call the county to help us get used police cars so that we can provide the basic services to our residents. So while many pontificate and while many have academic conversations, as Derek St. Lawrence is having, they don't have the responsibility for the day-to-day operations of the city. Everyone wants to talk about what we're not doing insofar as providing basic services and what we should be doing. But at the same time, no one really has an appreciation for how hamstrung we are by a system. January, you know, like I said again, everyone points to January. January is not going to answer every issue. We're going to get in there and we're going to have to unravel years of work that have not been done. We're going to have to deal with decades of not financial mismanagement, but of not budgeting in capital needs from Mount Vernon. Because, you know, even if we try and get our regular operational budget together, we have capital needs. Not just repairs, but capital purchases, so that we can. We need police cars. We need fire trucks. We need snow plows. We need sanitation trucks. We need roofs on buildings repaired, so that we can function. We need to repair our streets. We have $150 million in sewer work to be done, and the issues. These are legacy issues. These are legacy
issues, all those issues, and it's been kicked down the road. I know, but then we have to go beyond that. So what was the logic? Did Derek St. Lawrence, you may or may not want to answer this, I don't know, but Derek St. Lawrence move to make the first suit one favor with a judge, because I didn't think the judge wanted to take a stand, and then is well, that conceivably emboldened?
The judge hasn't ordered anything that I'm aware of in his suit yet. The temporary restraining order came from Comptroller Reynolds' filing. So I don't believe there's been an answer or an issue concerning Derrickson Lawrence's suit.
But I just thought that his suit emboldened her to take out a suit. I don't even know how she's paying for this suit.
Well, she pays for the suit the way she does all the other suits. She uses money that has not been allocated to her budget to do it, while not paying the bills for the attorneys that have been duly hired for the city of Mount Vernon. So again, she operates with impunity, and she continuously thwarts the efforts of government for us to do our job. So it's a real challenge.
Well, I understand. So you also mentioned before that the city council is functioning in an old world fashion, and there are a lot of holes in the way they operate. Do they have the capacity to put together something logical that will bring it up to date based on the technology and the conduct of this most recent comptroller? Do they have the capacity to act before January?
Insofar as a change of the charter, the council has put forth all of the legislation that we've put forth,
but it didn't work.
Put forth and passed right because we don't have enforcement powers. The charter does not give us enforcement powers, and we're not going to. Well, the state hasn't enforced it. They've told her to hand over records. They've told her to give us reports. She put a challenge to it. They said her challenge was dead in the water.
You've got to stop because you're just repeating old stuff. The point is that. That is the standard. We know what she's been doing all along. So are you suggesting that the city council does not
give any additional powers?
So none.
The city council,
in other words, there's no way to
stop to change the charter.
So there's no possibility for the funds, when they do come from the federal government, whenever they get dispensed, will go to her. And therefore, there will be no control of what she does with the funding.
That has not been decided. You have to go around, Lloyd. There are temporary restraining order saying that we cannot manage the money. We have paperwork to submit to the court to explain our argument. So no monies have come in. Nothing's been turned over to her. And I don't anticipate turning
money. I know
the
money hasn't come in because it hasn't come in. It wasn't going to necessarily go to her or to the city council or the government. But the point is, it will eventually arrive, and it probably will arrive before the end of this year.
And when it arrives, we will
Where
ask
will it
them
go?
To put it in an escrow account.
Okay, and does the city council have the authority to do that?
Hold on one second. Hold on one second.
No problem.
I'm sorry.
Hi.
Yes.
No problem.
I had to make sure we get to our destination. Okay.
None of this is your fault, but the thing is there anybody, meaning some sort of august body, whether it be the state or the county or the city, that has capacity to make sure that she's not in control of the money because she might not she doesn't even collect money in a timely manner.
So if the judge, what we're asking for, if the judge does not want to give us the power of the money, we are asking for the judge to put it in an escrow account.
And is that makes a lot of sense. So can that be done? that's up to the judge to make that decision?
It absolutely is. That would be up to the judge to make the decision, you know, but then at the same time, as we're looking to seek a financial control board, a lot of this would come under the state controller anyway. So there are multiple things that are in play right now.
So that was the thing in my mind, too, is that Napoli is still going to be he's still the controller, and is it a burden for him to take control over the funds that are coming from the federal government to hold it in escrow for the benefit of the city of Mount Vernon?
Well, we're not speaking about the fiscal operations of the city of Mount Vernon. State controller through a financial control board. So, you know, it would go way beyond. It would be way beyond the scope of just the ARP funds, this one, right?
Okay. So does that
and
look likely, or is this something that is really a legal issue and we don't know where that'll be or when that'll be resolved?
Hold on a second.
Sure.
Oh, I'm sorry.
No
so,
problem.
Yes, we again. I'm trying to get direction. So yes, we are looking for either a third party escrow account to hold it for now, or we will ask the court to assign a third party administrator. Because there is the opportunity to provide a third-party administrator, because these are not standard funds that are part of the city's operating budget. Okay.
You know, I've got to ask you another question that's a little bit on the outside of it all. Why is Mount Vernon, since it suffered such a debauched conduct by Deborah Reynolds as the comptroller for all these years? And unfortunately, it's like 1, 2, 3 different administrations. She's messed up, and with no difference in her conduct from beginning to end, and it still hasn't ended. And is there a reason why we're voting for a comptroller when the comptroller hasn't been able to manage it? Well, Maureen Walker supposedly was okay before. I don't think she had a problem like that.
No, not at all. But we are voting for a comptroller because as of now, our charter still states that our comptroller is an elected position. The only way that we will not be voting for a comptroller is if we remove that provision out of the charter. That was a discussion
and is
of
it too
the Charter
late?
Review Committee. It's too late for now. We're going to have another comptroller. So even if in the next year or two we change the charter, that comptroller will be able to finish out that term, and that will not go into effect until
And that's a four-year
term
anyway, right?
It's a four-year term,
right.
Absolutely.
Yeah. Okay.
So Mount Vernon missed the window to address this. I was in support of the elimination of the comptroller. But that work had to be done in 2019 primarily. And then early in 2020, there was not the political will to support that, unfortunately. I'm the mayor, but not the czar. And I can't make those type of stupid decisions by myself. So,
no, I understand
you
that.
You have to have cooperation of other electeds.
Well, I actually hold you in higher esteem than all of those designations that you chose, including the czar. So I think it's much higher than that. I guess the difficulty is, and I think you put, your head into it, and it makes sense. The city council needs to really update their charter, and that's probably going to take a lot of heavy lifting.
It's the Charter Review Commission. And, you know, the last one that was put together was in 2019. It sunsetted with the 2020 election. The new one will have to be put in place so that work can happen again. It's not the charter revision is not done just by the city council. It's done by 7 appointees of the city council, 7 appointees of the mayor, and 1 appointee of the commission itself for 15 members.
Oh, wow. I didn't realize that. That's
and you're
that's,
dealing with the
hopefully.
Entire Constitution. It's a huge undertaking.
It's huge.
And
yeah, it is.
It's not just passing an ordinance. It is looking because one change in one area changes everything.
Correct,
you have to look
correct.
At the interconnectivity of the charter. So you
no,
can't just say we're going to eliminate the role of the controller. That changes everything. So basically the charter is a rewriting of the Constitution. And so even the Senate and the House, it cannot rewrite the Constitution of the United States, you know.
Right.
In a year or two.
Well, that's,
so this
a, that's
is
a question.
A long process.
Is there some communities that can be emulated, or is it so unique to Mount Vernon that really there isn't that much to emulate, or maybe one aspect here and another aspect from another place? This is going to be a huge undertaking.
It's going to be a huge undertaking, a heavy lift, and it's something that it's something that we are in the process of undertaking, and we're going to have to do it very thoughtfully. It's not something that can be done politically. It has to be done with the best interests of Mount Vernon.
Yeah. Boy, that really is a big
challenge. It's a major update. Mm. So, you know, the council has passed ordinances, but those ordinances have not been upheld by the courts. They've been upheld in writing, but when they haven't held her in contempt. So we've even gone and asked her to be held in contempt. And no one has chosen to do that. They are tired in the court system of legislating Mount Vernon's day-to-day governance. That's not the court's job. And so they're standing
then why
back.
Do they, then why do they take the cases that come before them with regard to that? If
I can't
they
even
just
answer
don't
that.
Want to touch it. Okay, I don't get
much
it.
Much bigger
I mean,
than I am.
Well, you know, what can I tell you? It just makes no sense. It seems like it's a failure all along in a process, but it's been going on for so long, and I don't see the light at the end of a tunnel. And even revising the charter can take years. It's not going to happen in a year. Wow. Well, my God. So is there anything very positive to look at?
Look, in January we will have a new controller. And, you know, and if the state is working to manage our finances with us, hopefully we'll be able to accelerate. We'll be able to accelerate the whole process of financial recovery for our community. And I'm not talking about financial recovery from COVID. I'm talking about financial recovery from the tsunami of Deborah Reynolds.
Right. Absolutely. Unbelievable. Well, unfortunately, as always, very, very compelling issues, you know, and very deep. So we'll have to see how that goes. I have to let you go because we've got about 60 seconds left. Any last-minute words from you? Words of wisdom? Words of hope?
No, we're forward-focused. We are making the hard yet unpopular decisions that needs to be made to get our financial house in order.
I think
that's what
the
you
only
have
way
to do
function.
As a leader. As a leader, your decisions are not always popular, but they're necessary,
correct.
And that's why people put you in that position. So I will make
exactly.
the hard decisions that may not be politically popular, but they will be the right.
Well, that's the gauge. I wish you all the best. Look
Thank
forward
you
to
so
you.
Much.
We'll speak in another couple of weeks. All the best to you. Thank you.
All right. Be
Bye.
Well, Hezzy. Take care. Bye-bye.
You too. All the best. Bye. Well, there we have it, folks, none other than Sean Patterson Howard, the mayor of the city of Mount Vernon in New York. We'll be speaking to John and Lori Wiles, the driving crazy duo. Take care and goodbye.